Buffalo, birds, and grass all co-evolved together, and P.S., we humans and all other life did too. Dan O'Brien, today's guest, owner of Cheyenne River Buffalo Ranch and founder of Wild Idea Buffalo Company, knew this from a very early age, which brought the essence of nature and of life into focus. So he never needed any of today's buzzwords or phrases like organic or sustainable or regenerative agriculture. He knew the rule book was written long before the Native American Indians and the buffalo were here. And it's a story written into every blade of grass on the prairie. Join us. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for May 2024. So grab your earbuds and or a shovel and let's dig in.
Let me just ask you this before we start with the interview. I've read two different things where there's a distinct difference between bison and buffalo. The name of your company is Buffalo, but do you differentiate? Do you only have buffalo or are there bison or what's the deal there?
You're not the only one to have that question, I can assure you. Here's the deal.
Okay.
Bison are a North American deal. Buffalo are Asian.
Oh.
So we...
Okay.
Water buffalo, those kind of guys. Cape buffalo. But when the Europeans got out here on the Great Plains, they looked around and they'd never seen anything quite like that, but they looked like buffalo to them. So that's how they got the name. And the reason that we kept that name for the company is because right now I'm looking out the window and I'm looking at the Pine Ridge Reservation, and all our neighbors call them buffalo.
Gotcha.
Very seldom hear a Lakota guy or gal say bison. It's always buffalo.
Right. Okay.
So that's where we're at.
Okay, sounds good. Dan, we definitely need to start our chat about buffalo ranching and land restoration with a bit about your history helping to restore the peregrine falcon species, as early on you came to the conclusion that having a sole focus on one species was a fool's errand.
I still believe that. I don't think you can work with this species or that species, but the fact is, there's only one thing, and it's all the same thing. And, you know, that's a concept that seems to be difficult for Europeans, but it's a fact. I mean, you can go out on the prairie dog town, which is right outside my window here, and you say, well, what the hell good are these prairie dogs? Well, if you're careful enough, you can see that there are plants that are growing there that don't grow anyplace else. And strange thing, buffalo hang out on prairie dog towns, eating those things that grow there. And I think that's just an example, but it's all one piece. And, you know, we talk about buffalo as, or peregrine falcons, as a keystone species. But the real keystone piece, species of the Great Plains is grass.
Mm.
They all need grass. That's what ties everything together.
Right.
And so we like to think of our ranch not so much as a buffalo ranch, but really what we're doing is grass and soil and all those things that really are at the bedrock of an ecosystem.
Yes, great. Well said. Dan, you started with cattle. Why did you switch to buffalo?
Well, I am not an agronomist or a businessman or anything. I'm a god dang English major, okay? So I didn't know how to start, but I did know that I'd walk around the Great Plains, which I've always loved, and I could see that we were short of birds, you know? The birds that used to be there, even in the books, contemporary books, aren't there anymore. You know, I could see that something was missing. And, of course, it's that same connection with grass and soil. But I could see that what we really needed was a program that included everything. And when I started running cattle, I mean, and cattle have a bad rap. it's not their fault that we manage them the way we do. But because of the policies and of the economic system that we run under, it's made as if you were trying to degrade the ecosystem of the Great Plains, you would set up economic system just like we have. Hmm. You can only survive if you push it to the absolute edge of possibility. And if you push it a little bit too far, you've got a wreck on your hands. And we have a wreck on our hands right now.
Yes, we do. So tell us then about your ranch today, the land, acreage, number of buffalo.
Well, this place is, and we're really fortunate. You know, I came to South Dakota in 1970. Started off by bought a little acreage, 27 acres, for $7,200 with the house. The house was a wreck, so we had to redo everything. And I have never had a new car. I don't have a family. So it's been kind of tough. But from that beginning, this ranch is now 35,000 acres. And we've got about 800 buffalo on here now. So the way we do it is there's a lot of leased ground on this. The national grasslands, which I think there's 11 national grasslands now. It's just kind of a funny and ironic thing that the national grassland is managed by the Forest Service. Now, there are very few trees on a lot of the national grasslands, but that's what it is.
Right.
So we lease permit actually about 25,000 acres from the government, which is you, me, everybody. And then we have another 10,000 acres or so that's private. And we move those buffalo. The reason we could get the permit that we did was we wanted to try running buffalo in the winter time. So the permits are almost always for summer grazing. And so for whatever, 75 years, then X number of cows have been turned out on there every year at the same time, which puts on a lot of pressure on those grass species. And we figured, well, I don't want to put them out there and contribute to that, hitting it that hard every year. So we asked if we could put them out in the wintertime, and they said, well, yeah, but they can't live out there because you can't feed them out there. And we said, well, we don't really think they need to be fed in the wintertime. They've been out there for thousands of years. They can probably make it. And that's what we've been doing for the last 25 years. We just turn them out. In the wintertime, they take care of themselves. They come back in April, 1st of April. They look great. Nobody's done anything to feed them or anything else, which is, it's intuitive. No one did anything for the buffalo for how many years? Thousands and thousands of years. And when we got here, we being Europeans, there were millions of them. And so they should be able to get along just fine out there. And they could. And so we put them over there in the wintertime. We bring them back on the deeded land in the summertime where they can have their calves. And we just keep rotating that around. And we always keep them on the move. They move on their own, so basically, if we want to move from, and you know, so this thing is 8 or 10 miles square, you know, really it's kind of gerrymandered, but we can move them a long way, and they'll go easily, because that's what they do.
Right.
Buffalo do indeed roam.
I heard that in a song one time.
Yeah.
With the deer. So obviously every animal, every species is intuitive. That's how they've survived for so long. Tell us about once you bring them back in, you know, are they still acting very intuitively? What are their grazing habits like? I know with cattle, there are so many innovative, restorative models of mob grazing and things like that? And how do you work with buffalo? I mean, it almost sounds silly because they're really wild still, aren't they?
Well, you know, they're really not. There are no wild buffalo anymore. There's no more wild anything anymore. There's a fence around everything. And buffalo, if you go back and read the early accounts, starting with Lewis and Clark, they're really pretty docile. And, you know, I go out and give tours of the ranch, you know, showing people what we've been doing with the grass and et cetera. And we'll be out in the buffalo, you know, for an hour, and they're just walking around. And so they're not, they can't now, if you fuck, excuse my language, but if you fuck with them too much, they'll get scared. And they're really strong and really athletic. So you don't want to challenge them in that way. But we've never had any real problems with them, unless you're running them into a corral or something like that, because they'll fight then. But if they're out on the grass, if they get uncomfortable, they just move away from you. They're really not that hard to manage. I would much rather manage 500 buffalo than 500 yearling cattle, because the yearlings, you know, they don't have any sense, so they do all kinds of crazy things.
Let's jump into, just for a moment here, about the grass. What are you doing with the grasses? How are you working with that into the restorative properties?
Well, you know, as I said before, I'm not a scientist. I kind of wish I was. So when I looked at this problem of, hey, the grazing is deteriorating here, how can we fix it? Well, I don't know the chemistry. I don't really care much about the chemistry, to be honest with you. But I do know a little bit about wild animals, and they, you know, we have to trust them. Of course, now you have to believe in evolution, which I think that's part of our problem. The buffalo, you know, evolved to eat the grasses, but the grasses also evolved to be eaten by the buffalo. So it seems to me, it always has seemed to me, that, well, if you just replace that keystone species, you're going in the right direction. Because the grasses that we have here, the western wheatgrass, the switchgrass, all that stuff has felt the tread of buffalo for their whole existence.
The whole natural system is just mind-blowing. And when I was doing a little bit of reading about buffalo, even as they walk along and the seeds that ended up on their fur will just end up in new places as they walk around.
And
it's just amazing.
Yeah, the fur of a buffalo is an amazing thing. Like I say, we put our buffalo out on pastures in the wintertime, it just kills cattle. And, you know, that seems amazing, but when you think about it, it's not amazing at all.
Right.
The ones that, you know, couldn't hack it were dead long ago.
Hmm.
And every day every year I'm amazed at finding things like that. Just, you know, that wool, we call it wool, but, it, you know, they're shedding right now, and there's big sheets of this stuff are falling off. And when I walk around, because I'm a bird guy, kind of, you know, I find a meadowlark nest or sharp-tailed grouse nest or mouse nest. It all has buffalo fur in them.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not sure if that has anything to do with populations of birds or not, but it might.
So I've read that the bison's behavior differs as far as the size of the herd. Have you found that to be true, or is your herd just so big it all is?
Well, we believe in that theory. And, you know, we have 700-800 buffalo out there, but that's not a very big herd. You know, some of the herds were.
Well, yes. Historically.
So, yeah. But they're not like cattle at all. They Well, I mean, they are a little bit. They look a little like cattle, but they're matriarchal to begin with.
I know, they're feminists. I love that about them.
They are.
And, they're wild and they're feminists.
Well, they're the worst. But you'll see a grandmother, and you get to know these guys, and just by looking at them, you say, I remember you. And she'll have her calf with her from 4 years ago, and that one will have her calves from the last 3 years. So you have a little pod of, six or eight buffalo that hang around together. The males are not in that pod. And after they're 2 years old, they go, I don't know, watch football or something. but they graze differently. That group will be part of a larger group. I would love it if I could step back to 1750 and see if those large groups are part of a huge group, because I think probably they were.
Right.
And so they do difference. They move constantly, and you never know. You have 100 of them sitting out on a hillside, and you go out the next day and they're still there. The next day they're still there. The fourth day they're just gone, and they might be 5 miles away, which just does my heart good. It's good for the buffalo, and it's good for the grass and soil.
Yes, and it's not anything anyone necessarily thought about. It happens.
In fact, the more we think about it, the more we screw it up.
Right, yeah. My friend has this favorite saying I've incorporated into my life, which is, what I think is none of my business.
I'll have to think about that.
So tell us about any concerns you have in handling herd health. I mean, you just said that when they winter, they're gone, and then they all come back. Are there things that go on in the summer that you have to concern yourself about? Or,
I mean, health-wise? Like,
yes.
That?
Mm-hmm.
We've been on this place. Well, let's see. We'll go back even further. We've been doing buffalo for 30 years, and we've never had a veterinarian on the place.
Bravo. Okay.
Now, we once in a while will lose a cow, but when you have hundreds of them out there, to lose a cow or two a year is not a huge deal. The coyotes have to eat too. But no, we are believers in not doing any of that. The one thing that we do that has to do with health is we do not bring buffalo in and out of this herd. And that's a big problem in the cattle industry, because cattle are moving around all the time. We put 100 head in here with them to take this 50 and put them over there. And so that's not good for health. We don't vaccinate. We don't do any of that kind of stuff, because there's really, right now at least, there's no vector to bring those kind of diseases in. And we think that, it goes right back to the same thing we've been talking about, is they got along for eons without any veterinarians, without any injections, without any ivermectin or any of that kind of stuff. If we keep their environment clean, they'll be fine.
Right. And so maybe this is another very naive question, but everyone's always talking genetics, and then they worry about inbreeding.
Mm-hmm. And we're very aware of that. And I have to change a little bit about what I say. We do not move buffalo. Everything that comes on this place, whether it's born here or brought from someplace else, leaves this place hanging from a rail. We do a harvest in the field. Very, very humane. That's a huge part of what we're doing.
Right.
But to keep the genetics as good as we can, first of all, we don't believe in putting buffalo through a squeeze chute. We have to do it occasionally, but it's a mess, To do the genetic studies, first of all, it's expensive. And secondly, you got to put them through the chute to do it. So we don't want to do that.
Yeah. That would seem to affect the test just in itself, right?
all the like cortisol and stuff like that. It does.
Yeah.
It does. The hormones and stuff. But we go out, so we'll go to the Crane Trust or we'll go to TNC or one of those places where they're going to sell some bulls. And we go there, they've got it all set up. Everybody's going to go through the chute. Everybody's going to get tested for everything. We'll buy 5 or 8 bulls every few years. So we know we have some buffalo coming onto the place.
Great.
But they've all been really tested in every way you can.
Right.
So, you know, theoretically at least, we have a clean herd and we intend to keep it that way.
What a good fortune for those bulls to end up over with you where they're just going to be roaming freely around. Yeah. That's great.
They just hang out, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Well, tell us about your Wild Idea Buffalo Company, and that incorporates, of course, the selling of the meat, and maybe share a little bit about when you harvest your meats. And by the by, I appreciate that you use words like harvesting instead of slaughtering. How many do you harvest in a year? How old are they? And time of year that you do it and all of that?
First of all, we don't believe in putting animals through contemporary meat facilities, kill floors, all that kind of stuff. If you've never been to a place like that, a feedlot and then with a slaughter plant next door, and you're eating meat, you should go. Because when you do, you'll either become a vegetarian or you'll start buying our buffalo meat, one or two. And I couldn't do that. I couldn't send buffalo to that kind of a situation. So I said, well, what if we just shot them in the field? And everybody said, oh, you can't do that. This is 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And like I said, I'm not a scientist, but I am an English major, so I actually read the regulations. And my God, you can do that. You can. And you got to have inspectors, and you got to do all that kind of stuff. So that's what we did. We figured out how to do this, and where we could kill them in the field. And it is the most amazing thing that I've ever had anything to do with. That, you know, I'm reading. I'm just looking right now. I've got on the shelf over here is Lewis and Clark, and they're talking about some of the hide hunters, which were a grizzly group, but they would sit in one place and shoot 30 or 40 buffalo. And I've been reading this for years. And how the hell do they do that? You know, well, it turns out that they're tame. You start chasing them, and you won't kill 30. But if you just sit there and you're calm, yeah, you can do that. Mm. Now, we don't do it that way, but we take some of those techniques. We have a big semi truck. We'll drive it to a buffalo ranch, set up. It's a complete skinning, eviscerating, cutting plant, and with an inspector sitting right there. Mm. We'll pull that in, and we have a pickup truck rigged up with a little lift on the back, and I have a guy in the front seat driving who's a real good shot. And we just drive out into the crowd, and the inspector sitting in the seat beside us and say, let's take that third one from the end there. And he'll look, and this is pro forma, but they say, yeah, he looks healthy. They always do. And so pow, and they just go, one shot's all we get. And I don't know, I think we've had to do what we call a safety shot 3 or 4 times in the last couple of years. But you can shoot 3 or 4 of them in a row if you wanted to. And they are not, that doesn't bother them at all. You go to try to put them in a truck, take them to a slaughter plant, and they're all over the place. Mm. They go crazy. So we take those up, pick them up with a little lift on the back of the pickup, take them back to the semi, winch them in there, and at that point, they're just meat. So, you know, we've done all of the respect that we think is appropriate. And we have a lot of Indian guys who have been working for us and learned a lot from them. You know, we do a little prayer before we start and smudge everything, smudge the rifle, smudge everybody that's going to be working on it. And it works fine. Now, the reason everybody doesn't is it's expensive. You know, you got five guys there to kill one buffalo, and we might do 10 in a day that way, where the plant is doing 1,000.
Right. 10 every few minutes, yes.
Yeah, you know, which to me says, well, that's another problem.
Yeah, so, many, I would say, yes.
Yeah.
So if you do 10 in a day, how many would you say you do in a year?
I'm terrible at this, but we've had to have spreadsheets and all kinds of stuff. Our goal is, I think, 700 for this year.
Okay.
Now we do our ranch, about five other ranches, two of which are Ted Turner's ranches, and we work pretty close with the tribes. And, you know, we'll do this. Basically, what we do is so we'll buy 20 buffalo from you. And they say, fine, bang, bang. And then we pay them for those buffalo, but they're not in a truck. They're in a truck, but they're hanging up in the cooler. So that's kind of the way we operate.
I know about the nutrition of the meat and the ratio of omega 3 to 6. And the importance of that to our health.
Well, you know, that's a little bit out of my wheelhouse.
Okay.
We're pretty sure that the acids, the amino acids, are much better from a wild animal. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense along for the same lines as a lot of the rest of this makes sense. We also evolved to eat wild animals, not animals that have sat in a feedlot getting pumped up with corn.
Right.
Those things produce a different food.
Yeah.
So I know that.
Well, Dan, you obviously are doing things in a very intuitive way yourself. And is there something that you would like to share that either is a way that you're working and being with these buffalo and harvesting them that we haven't talked about or that you feel like you would like to share with other buffalo ranchers or perhaps with people that might be thinking about becoming a buffalo rancher?
Well, buffalo are not the answer. The answer, because you can put a buffalo in my room here and keep it alive. And you could even eat it at the end of that. It's how the buffalo reacts to the ecosystem that you put it in. And we're really this, and I tell people this ranch is really about birds. Instead of going out and doing all the tests and everything for the soil and the vegetation, what I do is I take a walk and sort of just think what I have for birds.
And I love that.
They're a way better range analyst than I am. And if I go out there and we have thousands of meadowlarks on this ranch.
Mm.
There are places, I grew up in Ohio, and there aren't any meadowlarks there anymore. And to me, that is a huge tragedy. It's on the level of what's happening in Palestine now. It's horrible. It's a horrible, horrible thing. And if I walk out there and I see sharp-tailed grouse and meadowlarks and bobolinks, I figure we're doing a pretty good job.
Yes, I love that. That's great. Well, ultimately, as you've been saying, Dan, the bulk of your work is about understanding ecosystems. And do you, beside keeping track of what birds or listening to the birds and seeing the birds on your property. Are there certain things you do with grasses? Do you buy seed ever and throw it out? Or in those areas that your buffalo are in from April until winter time again? Or
this ranch was put together with 6 or 7 different pieces of ground, ranches, et cetera, et cetera. And most of those places had had some farming. There have been some, there's some fields here that are, you know, not huge, but 100 acres, maybe 150, 200 acres, that were in wheat. And those places, you know, basically the farmer, who, and it's his job, kill everything out there except the wheat. And so we came in and said, how are we going to do this? Because, you know, we had a list of not very many, but maybe 15 species that we would like to see. You know, on the better parts of the ranch, we had those species. So we did what the USDA tells you to do. We went out and sprayed it with Roundup and killed everything. And then we planted these 10 different species in there. And that kind of worked. It took a long, long time, like 10 years. It cost a lot of money. And even when we got done, we had 10 species. Huh. And, you know, what's probably there was 180 species out there originally before we started to fool with it. And so what we have found is that you can do it that way. It's more important how you put the animals on there. And even more important than how you put them on there is how you take them off. Because that soil and those grasses need rest. You know, you can graze them hard, but they need to be rested.
Right.
And, you know, it took us 15 years to get some of those places to where they were, you know, they looked like they were grass and not an old field. But still, we had fields with 10 species in them. And we wanted fields with 130 species in it.
Right.
And so we have found over the years, you know, first of all, the life of one man is not long enough to see much difference. But what we found out that if you just leave it, those seeds have a way of getting back in there. It's slower than hell. And what you have to watch out for is getting in trouble where, you know, it dries out. You got to use that field.
Mm-hmm.
That's what kills you. If you have to use that field because you're out of pasture, then, you know, it sets you back 5-6 years.
Wow.
So it's a big commitment, and economically, it's completely nuts. Nobody, no money manager would ever give the nod to that kind of stuff. But that's not what we're doing here. We're doing something else.
And I thank you for that.
Yeah.
So as the regenerative organic movement gets going, and now I notice that your farm is getting involved with ROC, regenerative organic certification and everything, as you see this momentum building and see the ideas coming out more and growing, would you comment on that? And I don't care if it's a negative or a positive comment.
You know, it's tough because the idea behind ROC and organic and all those things is good. But really what it's turned out to be, it's another way to sell stuff. And that is bad. We signed up for all that stuff because we were already doing it. You know, it was we've never had any trouble getting certified for Audubon Friendly and ROC and all that kind of stuff because, you know, we're already doing it. So why not? I mean, we put the whole ranch into conservation easement. And, you know, that was a big chunk of money to get. And that big chunk of money cost us nothing, because that's exactly what we were going to do anyway.
Right.
And so when we first figured that one out, that made it a lot easier. But it's not ongoing, of course.
Right.
But all of those things, I think all those things are good. if for no other reason, it gets people thinking about it. I don't think that the average shopper at Costco knows anything about it. It's a little seal on the package, but behind that, there's some good thinking. There's some real good people behind it.
Definitely.
And the other thing, and this is huge, we don't know what to do, but we got to do something.
Yes. Unbeknownst to perhaps many who are listening today, you are an author and you write fiction and nonfiction. And, you know, I've got to say, The Rites of Autumn is the only book of yours so far that I've seen. And the book has almost like an ecosystem effect in it. It really slowed me down when I was reading it. It was really kind of palpable. It really brought me into that time, and more than the time, but the space that's needed for a journey with a falcon.
Thank you for all that. I mean, I appreciate it. I wish I would have had all that in mind when I was writing it. But, you know, I think what you might be feeling is just the magnetism of the Great Plains.
You know, of course, yes.
Such a special place, and it's so underrated or so underrealized,
right,
that, and you know, this is where I live, what I do every day, and so it becomes a lot easier for me to get into that mode, and I think that really is important. I mean, I would like to write love stories about interracial marriages in New York, but I don't know a damn thing about that. So... But falcons and buffalo.
And prairie. There you go.
So.
Yeah. Well, one more question for you, Dan. What's your favorite cut of meat?
You know, I just love our buffalo. It's really, really good. And there's some cuts there that are stuff that you order in a fancy restaurant on the coast. But for me, being basically a Midwesterner, I like the roasts. You know, a roast done, a few potatoes and a few carrots in there. It takes me back, for one thing.
Mm.
And it's really good food. It's really good food.
Dan O'Brien, since he says he's a bird guy and I think he's a buffalo rancher, we'll just call him a natural guy and thank him for being here with us. And you might want to check out some of his books, both fiction and nonfiction. We can be found at cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are where you'll hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.